Welcome to the Pivot Podcast, everyone, and we have a special episode in store for you today. He has served as Nova Scotia's 28th Premier from 2013 to 2021, in addition to representing the riding of Annapolis for just shy of two decades. He has been leader of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party from 2007 to 2021 before being succeeded in the role and stepping into his new role as strategic business advisor with local law firm Cox & Palmer. Jeff and I are thrilled to welcome the Honorable Stephen McNeil. Stephen, welcome to the podcast today, sir.
Excited. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
I wanted to start by, first of all, just thanking you for your public service as an elected official. I'm sure there's been, you've accomplished a lot in that time. There's been some highs and some lows, as I can only imagine. As you reflect back on your time as Premier, I'm interested to understand, what were your biggest pride points in that role? You know, what were you thinking and how do you feel about having the decision to step away from that role?
First of all, thanks for having me. I love the job of, and it was a privilege to be in elected office. Not only the Premier, go back to being the MLA, and why I chose to run really was to try to make a difference in the community I lived in. And then as life unfolded, things happened and more opportunities came, and one of them being leading the party and then getting a chance to lead the province. For me, it was a chance to help shape the direction and change the trajectory of it. If you look back to 2013, you know, we were in huge deficit. We had out-migration young people, and that had been happening for really decades. It wasn't something that just happened overnight. We were seeing, you know, many people that would have been either my age or younger who thought that in order to create a career or a life for themselves, it was somewhere else, not here. So I wanted an opportunity to help shape the province and through public policy, because I believe good government matters. I believe policy matters. Really, I was proud of the fact that, you know, more young people were choosing to stay and live and work here. Their fiscal health was better. We were seeing investment at an unprecedented level. We were seeing exports growing, not only in our traditional markets, but we had seen the Asia market take off for us. It had a huge impact, particularly on coastal communities where I represented in the fishery. We weren't catching any more fish, whether it was lobster or sea cucumber, what it was. We were getting the right value for it. Those were all things when you looked at the bottom line. But when I looked at other things, presumed consent. We're the first jurisdiction in Canada where we're all organ donors, mm-hmm. unless we opt out. Everybody else that's opt in. It was a view that I thought we were, you know, everyone wanted to be an organ donor, but the system wasn't prepared for that, particularly if you lived in rural communities. So by doing the opt-out program, we also hardened the system to be able to make sure that we were fulfilling the wishes of Nova Scotians. And as I said many times, we stopped bearing hope. I was able to be involved with Home for Colored Children to correct some what I think injustices that have been historic, partially not our individual parents, but their generation had created a province that wasn't as welcoming to everyone. So those are some of the things that I'm very proud of and hang on to.
Mm. How far do you think we've come on the province that's welcome for everyone? I just had lunch with someone prior to this, and I was a Chinese immigrant, and we were actually just chatting about how when I was 30 years ago, when I grew up outside of Yarmouth, I didn't see a whole lot of Chinese immigrants, and now I just feel like we have people here of all kinds of different cultures.
If you look over the last decade, the province has become much more welcoming out of the fact we've had to in some ways, because we needed people. We needed, you know, we saw our demographics. We needed people driving economic growth. We saw many of them coming here driving business opportunities, also fulfilling jobs that there weren't enough people here to do. And I think Nova Scotians should be proud of the fact that if you look globally, you look at what's happened. Brexit was out of an anti-immigration, yeah. The European Union. If you look what happened south of the border, political leaders rallied around this anti-immigration strategy to become president of the United States. When you, at the same time, in our small pocket of the world, people were embracing it. And it's funny, I always say one of the things that I think woke all of us up to this concept was, if you remember during the prime minister announced the Syrian refugee numbers that we were, as a country, were going to welcome. There was an incident that happened where a young boy was washed ashore.
Yeah. And
it was during the federal election of 2015. And at that moment, you saw a shift because we moved away from a policy where you had to sponsor someone where, and communities began to sponsor individuals and groups of individuals. So it became almost a rallying cry for the community. Like Peace by Chocolate is one of those examples that's well documented, and Antigonish did an extraordinary job. But that's happening in other communities. Maybe not to the extent that you would have seen or the growth of Peace by Chocolate had, but you saw that where we all took ownership in it. And I think that's what's continued to build on the immigration piece. That's really, and to be honest with you, like often good public policy, it happens by accident.
Sure.
It was one of those where we rallied around what was a cause that we all wanted to participate in to help the federal government achieve its the numbers that they were going to take from what was happening in Syria. And in many ways, I think it blossomed our communities because there's a myth out there that while the bulk of the immigration is happening in the Halifax area, it's happening in many counties across the province where we're seeing our numbers increase.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said about that image of the young boy washed. I know exactly what you're referring to. And isn't that fascinating that right away I can even picture that and how terrible that was, right? And it really, I think people really did rally behind that.
And it was interesting because former Prime Minister responded, didn't say anything inappropriate, just said it with no emotion. The current Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau, had emotion around the issue. And it's, in many ways, I think, is what caught people's attention towards the current Prime Minister was he expressed what we were feeling, where Prime Minister Harper didn't say anything wrong. He just didn't say what the kind of feeling that the rest of us were having. And I think it was actually one of the things that also begin to turn the political tides as well.
Yeah, I wonder if it makes us, I've said for some, we've had actually Tarek Haddad on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So we've heard about his story, fascinating. I've said for a long time, anybody who's anti-immigration is not paying attention. I'm not sure it's a coincidence that immigrants own such, you know, significant portions of this province and other provinces. They're exceptionally hardworking people. Who have really good intentions for when they come to Canada, right? Sometimes I feel like people who were born here kind of take things for granted.
We're certainly comfortable,
yeah,
in the sense of we don't take the risk in many ways. That's a generalized statement, but we're not as, listen, you know, many of the people that I would have graduated high school with, which wasn't yesterday, you know, they would have become public servants or would have gone into that type of role as opposed to more of the risk taker, the entrepreneur, finding their way where, I mean, we live in a city, that is built, look at the Lebanese community here.
Yeah.
They, in many ways, have shown us how immigration can work. It's not a single family, it's a community of people. They built places where they worship together. They compete like hell against each other during the day, but they take risk. They know what it's like to come from a part of the world that turmoil is in, where things aren't as comfortable as we have and aren't as fortunate as we have. So they come and they take that kind of risk. And it's spreading. And to me, they then set the example, okay, how do we, you mentioned at lunch today, you know, imagine that you have an entrepreneur in the city who has a Mandarin-speaking person on staff for this very reason, that they want to make sure that the Chinese who come to Nova Scotia, whether it's to go to education, want to rent an apartment, what it is, they feel comfortable that we've embraced that in their language. 10 years ago, that would have been unheard of.
Yeah.
But it's meeting that person where they are today. And that simple, those simple acts of, you know, providing that place of worship, providing the fact that you can have a conversation in their language, is making people say, hey, you know, this is a great place. And I think you're starting to see in the generation of our own children who now are saying, you know what, I think we can do that and are much more entrepreneurial than my generation was.
Do you miss them?
Love, yeah.
Even just hearing you give these responses, I can still see the fire in the belly. I mean, was it hard to come to the conclusion that you were going to step away as premier? And how did those thoughts start percolating until you eventually went public with that?
So to answer the first question, I miss it every day. I love the job, but it was, I'll never have a job as fulfilling and as rewarding as that was. And I felt we felt at the time. We could have gone again. But I believe this, if you look across the country, particularly small provinces, there's a window for you to do stuff. We were an active government. We did a lot of policy stuff that not necessarily everybody liked. We focused on trying to put the fiscal health of the province in order so that we could all benefit in the rise of what we thought was going to be the success of the province. And that takes a toll. And I think if you go into the realizing 2 terms is a long time in elective office, particularly in this day and age, and if you look historically across the country, 3rd and 4th terms of governments is when things go off the rails. Cabinet ministers have been elected a long time. They think they're there because of them. They forget about the team concept. What about, you know, what was the objectives of the original? Why did we enter politics? So I had always had in my mind 8 to 10 years was the window for me, that I would, if I was privileged enough to do that. Never thought I'd get to the point where I'd be able to have that conversation with myself that, you know what, God, we've been elected for 8 years now. What are you gonna, because you just don't think of it that in those terms. Yeah. But for the health of the province, I think it was time for me to go for us. But yeah, I'd miss it every day.
How much did COVID play into that?
Not at all. I had,
because I would say that from someone that wouldn't know any better, it could have been easy to make the leap to saying, you know, our premier is exhausted from public policy decisions during a pandemic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I had actually, it's funny, if you go back, I called the host back in January of 20, because I had made up my mind I was leaving. And I called the host back early to get our budget through, which is, if you look historically in the province, no one calls the host back in January.
Okay.
And I was doing it to kind of use March break as a buffer, send our team away, families do what they were going to do, and then I was going to express to them in April that I was leaving, giving them a bit more of a window. Then COVID hit and all of that changed. And then, of course, worse than COVID really was Portapique, which was, so I didn't think I was actually going to be able to leave. I thought I was going to fight another election, and I was preparing for that, and then the window opened up in August, like the summer months, and then I just said, if I don't go now, I'm here for the long haul. And listen, it was a privilege. Loved every minute of it. And it's been an adjustment even for someone who had determined their own exit. Because it does matter. I am excited about public policy. I do get engaged by it because I think the province can be successful and is successful. And I think there's everything you can do here, you know, that there's a belief you had to go to Toronto to be in your business. Well, guess what? You don't have to be in Toronto. You can be here. There's all kinds of activities. It's valuing what, you know, you come from a fishing community, valuing that product. I used to say to people, I can't afford to buy lobster. I said, well, you can't ask me to go around the world and sell the world's best product and you don't want to pay for it. The two don't add up. And it was the best rural economic strategy we had by just saying, pay us what it's worth. Mm-hmm. More, deckhands got paid more, the boat owners got paid more. All of that stuff mattered. Car dealers sold more trucks, all of that kind of stuff. I get jazzed up by it.
You said something interesting earlier. I think you referenced the Lebanese community and just the notion of taking risks, and that takes a certain kind of character. And we're all shaped by our backgrounds and our upbringings and where we're from. And you just you gave another example just about the enduring spirit of us Nova Scotians. In your travels as premier and throughout your life, I mean, what are the kind of character traits that you believe in today's age kind of help one be successful? I mean, what is it that you see in people? What is it that you believe made you successful, but also in others, and what needs to be kind of developed?
I think part of it is there's obviously a level of belief you have to have in yourself. I think surrounding yourself by good people, being comfortable enough, particularly in leadership roles, to let people around you flourish. Don't be insecure enough that people around you are looking are being successful. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Oftentimes, leaders stifle that in teams. I felt proud of the group of people that I was with, and I think there's a kindness matters in life and how we interact with people. And there's always the temptation for, you know, to get even, instant gratification kind of thing. That never works. Trust your instincts on that, in the long haul. Supporting people, being kind to people, you know, the kind of the values that we grew up on. And life works out. You know, my life is no different than anyone else. I'm probably the most unlikely guy to have been premier, but yeah, that's, when I look around, I think, you know, those values of hard work and believing in yourself and not worrying about someone else's success. For a period of time, it almost felt like when someone was successful, we were viewing it as that we weren't, as opposed to celebrating that success. And I feel that we've kind of gotten there again, where we're celebrating people's successes and bragging about the fact that, you know, Clearwater sold for $1 billion in this little province. That's an impressive number for any company. At one point, we complained about them. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I think that's part of that conversation.
No, it's a good message. And I mean, there's enough opportunity for everybody. Oh. I mean, you mentioned you don't have to go to Toronto. I'm a proud Maritimer. We moved out there for over 10 years and came back for the opportunity. And I'm realizing it now. I'm one of many.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great place. Quality of life for kids.
When you said you were the least likely person to be premier, what makes you say that?
Well, it's funny.
Can we go back to, you know, pre-politics, perhaps?
Yeah. I was shaped, obviously, you know, like all of us were shaped by things that happened in our lives. Probably the biggest event of my life was the death of my father when I was 8. I'm one of 17 kids. I'm the 12th of them. Same parents. For your listeners, they'll all wonder how many dads and moms are the same parents. And we lost our dad in his mid-40s. My youngest brothers would be 18 months old, and we kind of went every couple of years thereafter. So that would have shaped us. Our mother became the first female sheriff in Canada. At the time my father died, she had no job, no driver's license, and hadn't worked outside of our house. And went on to have, I always say she had two lives, I think the job she enjoyed the most, which was a stay-at-home mom caring for us, and then went on to have a very public life in being the first female sheriff in Canada, and had been honored in both provincially with the Order of Nova Scotia and other aspects. But I always remember, you know, and I can't imagine what she must have felt like on that night when my father died. But she stayed. She kept a belief in herself, and she kept a belief in us. And there was kind of no shortcuts. You had to kind of carry your weight. But I didn't do the typical route of going to university. I wanted to live where I was. I wanted to raise our kids there. So I ended up going to trade school, becoming a refrigeration mechanic and appliance repair technician. Ran a business in the valley for 17, 18 years.
In that field?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then, 17, 18 years, there's a connection here. That's the same length of time I was in public office. So when I entered, it was never to be the leader of the party. I was really to represent and help shape the community I lived in. It was very good to us.
When you started as an MLA, did you quit that business? Was that right around the same time?
I kept it for a period of time,
yeah,
and then I transitioned out when I was reelected.
Okay,
and then
there's risk there, you know.
If I had gone to government, it would have happened quicker. But I wasn't in government at the time; I was in opposition, so I was able to transition. So, but I became the a leader of the party in third place, in 2009, when the NDP were elected, we hadn't defeated a one-term government in over 100 years. So the logic was they would be reelected, at least in a minority.
Got it. Yeah.
They would hold power. So if you look, typically political leaders get a couple of cracks at the can and then you're out the door. So in my case, I just didn't think the opportunity would be there for me. But I also then took on the role of, okay, I'm going to rebuild the party. And it was really a great learning experience for me, because it was you took the burden of away from of having to kind of, and I think it's a great lesson for everyone. You follow your instincts, your gut. You know what's right. Do it. Instead of letting the burden of the responsibility and worry about what the fallout's going to be, in terms of, I thought, well, I'm never going to have to, I've only got one election left in me, I'm not going to need it. So I was able to go into riding associations, for example, organizations, and say, come on now, you can't tell me the only people who want to run for us are people who look like me. You can't tell me the only people that you have, who have you asked? And I could be much more confident and which I should have been in 09, but I was released from the burden of worrying about what was going to happen 5 years from now. Because historically, I knew what was going to happen. So we had a very diverse great slate of candidates, and really started around 2012, and then government started to change, falter, and opportunity came. And we ended up winning in 2013, which was the first time in 100 years that a government had been changed over in a one cycle.
I wouldn't have known that significance at the time.
And then being re-elected in 17 was the first time for the Liberal Party that they won two majority governments since Angus L. MacDonald, which is the Second World War in Nova Scotia. So, you know, those things were happening. And a lot of that goes back to, I think, 2012, and was rooted into that when I was kind of released from the worry about, stop worrying about what's going to happen, just do what's going to be right, set a diverse plan here, which we did with candidates, and they were solid community people who, even through those difficult times when we were making some, you know, very difficult public policies, they were able to weather the storm in 2017 and have us reelected. And I always say we got elected because we governed. We didn't govern to get elected.
Mm. Yeah, we had Mike Savage on a few months ago now, and he's told us the best elected officials, politicians, are the ones that don't graduate from school and want to get into politics. They do what you've done. You know, they run businesses. They work in the private sector, and then they want to see change happen, but they want to take on themselves and go into office. That's an honorable, great way to get into politics. Would you agree with that?
I very much so.
Doesn't his passion for public policy kind of remind you of Mike Savage?
A little bit, yeah.
It's getting away, yeah.
Well, I loved it because there's very few places. Like, if you've been in the legislature the day we passed presumed consent, you know, very seldom do you get unanimous consent in the House. You have people crying because people are telling the story of either their own. One case had a minister describing her son, who was an organ donor, who lost his life, and the impact that had. And there were people knowing people who have been on wait lists. You know, that's a powerful place to be able to introduce legislation, to be able to do those kinds of things. Acknowledge historic wrongs when it came to the Home for Colored Children. I remember one of the residents was, I remember we were getting ready to do it at the legislature, and it was fundamentally something I believed in, even when in opposition. And I said, "This, you know, we have to do whatever we can to correct this, and acknowledge the wrong, and how do we learn from it?" Yeah. We're getting ready, and lo and behold, one of the residents is the guy I went to high school with. And I'm stunned by it because I had no idea. He moved around from, you know, foster homes, and he happened to be, for a period of my high school years, in the same high school I went to. We played basketball together. He would tell you he was better than me, and I'd tell you he probably was. But I was much taller, so that helped.
That I believe.
Yeah. So, but, you know, and unbeknownst to me, but I knew through other people, we were about to change a whole bunch of people's lives for the better simply by acknowledging we heard them. And there's very few places that you can say that you've done that, and this is one of those for us as a government. We're viewed as a government that was very fiscal minded.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that. And oftentimes, what gets overlooked is the investments we made in people. Whether it was presumed consent, the Home for Colored Children, whether it was acknowledging the changes we did in child welfare, on how we deal with children who come into the care of the province. Those were things that, I think will have lasting legacy and future governments can change the fiscal direction of the province. They can't undo that social changes that we made, which I think will last indefinitely.
When you started as premier, anything that you really wanted to get done that you learned quickly was either perhaps impossible, or looking back, you're like, well, I really wish that we would have been able to pull this particular thing off or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of what we have, I always say government, sometimes you're forced, your hand is forced to you. We came in with a massive hole fiscally that we had to kind of get out of. But looking back, I wish we'd actually been able to deal with the housing issue in a much more forward-thinking way. And I mean that in the sense of, I'm not a big believer in rent caps. It happened because of COVID, really. But there's a better way to do housing than we are currently now. And, that would have been a level of collaboration between the city and provincial governments and the private sector. We work very closely with the private sector in all aspects of our government and our economy, really. And I think if you look at it, it's been some of the benefits of our economy benefited from that. We felt we had a role to play, but if we weren't necessarily the lead in every one of those, whether it was Cove across the harbor or whether it was work we did with Volta, the housing market, we didn't get that done, and it would have been better, I think, for the province. And we have to get away from idealing that developers are money-hungry people. Yeah, they want to make money, sure. So does everybody. That's kind of the name of the game. And they're part of the solution for us. And the municipality is a big player, particularly in HRM, on how do we best deliver public policy. It doesn't require, quite frankly, a lot of public money. It requires a level of cooperation that we didn't get done. And the new government, when it came in, one of the things it did was take this file, and we'll see where it ends up in a way. And I wish them much success in it, because I think we need the success in that. Otherwise, people are going to start questioning the immigration policies, questioning growth, and all that stuff if they're not feeling part of it.
To what degree did, so for example, you're talking about, maybe I'll back it up. There was something that came into our office and delivered a presentation on current rents and how we can solve this homeless issue and things like that, right? And a major part of it, I eventually stuck my hand up and I said, listen, it's not a lot of people feeling bad for landlords out there, right? Like, cause the presentation did, display this kind of, conundrum that everybody was in, where you needed more supply, that the rent wasn't high enough to fuel the supply. We're all caught in this kind of weird situation here. But it's, I'm kind of curious, like that lack of sympathy, or it got me thinking to, I don't know, to what degree social media plays into something like this. Where, you can really fuel an idea really, really quickly, right? Regardless how much truth it is. Now, when you started in politics, there was no social media.
No.
And then by the time you were premier.
Oh, I was.
It was just starting. And then by the time you were done, that would have been quite an evolution.
Yeah, it was funny. I think it was the 2009 election where social media became the first. And we, had no concept of it, really. And people were using it for good.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh there. It's just
but be able to get people were able to get your message out.
And it was fair point. Yeah.
In 2013, we were elected. Everybody knew how to use it for good and for bad.
Yeah.
So, you learn very quickly a story that is not true.
Yeah.
Once it got on social media, people began to believe it, and it became So when I first started, Facebook wasn't even. And then in the end, and I still think it's in a healthy place to be. I'll share a secret with you. In 2013, I had all kinds of social media accounts. I had them my whole time in Premier. I never saw them. I had when I first, Facebook first came to my cell phone, and I said, oh, this I can't. I took it off my phone and I hired this young person. And we laughed.
Communications director.
Yeah. No, it's this person who handled my social media. We laugh about it today. She's same age as like our kids. And I said to her, you're the only person who's allowed to tell me no. Because not everybody finds me as funny as I find myself. So if I send something to be posted and you don't think it's appropriate, don't post it. But it wasn't so much for that. That was kind of the humor about it. It was because there's an unhealthy level of, it's just mentally you can't sustain it. And for me, I didn't want to be making decisions based on what, you know, the person in their basement sitting in their pajama bottoms is talking about. I wanted to make decisions based on the evidence that I had been given without all of that noise around it.
Yeah.
And real people. Even when we were doing our battle, so I never looked at social media my entire time in elected office. Because that's not what mattered. What didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was what you and I are doing right now. And I used to say to these particular people, and they remember this, some of my colleagues, particularly when we were in the heat of union battles, I would say, do me a favor, get off your social media when you go home on the weekend and go to the grocery store, go to the liquor store, hear what people are telling you, and then come back and say, geez, this is not the same conversation. I said, no, because you're on the weekend, you're in the real world. When you're on social media, you're in a place where everyone's going to voice an opinion, and it's not necessarily, they just get caught up in it, and it's an unhealthy place to be. So for me, I just never...
It perpetuates an argument, doesn't actually solve anything.
Well, yeah. The other part of it is, how do you know what's true, what isn't? You know, someone can create whatever they want.
Sure.
When you're making decisions, you need to be able to get the best evidence you have and try to make it from there. So yeah.
So
I'm probably the only elected person who wasn't on social media.
I think that's right.
So you became, just to shift gears a little bit from your political life to what you do now. I can only imagine the offers that you got when you left office. And I mean, you certainly had choice, I think, maybe fair to say. You're now a strategic business advisor with Cox and Palmer. So I'm interested to understand a little bit about what that means. What is your function in the firm? And, you know, we at RBC, we talk a lot about being trusted strategic advisors ourselves, obviously in a different sense. But what are you doing now that lends itself to consensus building and building trust and with the folks that you come across in this role?
Yeah, so what I do at the firm is really support client development oftentimes. So as you can imagine, like the bank, there's certain aspects that do their thing. So there's certain law that's practiced that I'm not involved in at all. I'm really on the commercial side. So I would be working with either current clients who are looking, how do they grow their opportunity? You know, what if they're looking to export into certain markets, how do they deal with that? I don't do any government relations, nor do I do any lobbying. That's not my bailiwick. I do give strategic advice on how to deal with governments of both levels. And I go and look for clients and support clients who may want to become members of the firm. So anyone who's listening is looking, needing a law firm, Cox and Palmer is a great firm here in Halifax. So that's really what my role is. And to be honest with you, what I love about it still, in some ways, it's my way to continue to help grow the province. The firm is a regional firm, but I'm here in Halifax. So it's my way of trying to help support and continue the message that things can happen here. I do it in a way from our firm's point of view is that we want part of the action, in the sense that we obviously want clients.
Of course.
But I do it. This is a great place to do business from. If you're in the financial sector, we're closer to New York, or as close to New York as Toronto, and closer to London, the financial markets. If you look from an export point of view, we're a great launchpad for companies. That's really what my role is, and I consider it an extension from where I was in lots of ways of just trying to move growth. And I go back, it's and try to promote the idea that let's stop complaining about the success of people. As I said to you earlier, I want the developers to make money. That means they're putting money back into their economy. There's nothing wrong with it. I want Ameri shareholders to make money. There's nothing wrong with that. And the fact that we have that headquarters, a global company here in Halifax, we should stop beating the crap out of them and celebrate them and say, how do we get more of those to come and take a building and develop it to a point where that's a huge success story in 20 years, really, from 1999 through to today. That's a huge success story. But it gets caught up in the political conversation sometimes and the general conversation about, not in a good way. And that's why I think it takes leaders, whether it's political leaders or business leaders, to say, wait, let's just take a pause here for a minute and put your oar in the water and say, hey, you know, sure, the URB should keep them controlled. Sure, we should make sure some of the developers aren't gouging us. Sure. But let's not, there's a way to do that without punishing them too, allowing it to grow.
So what do you attribute that mindset to? Because I think the Nova Scotia of old might have been, maybe not as growth oriented as we are today. Do you sense a shift in people wanting this province to, you know, really be in the same conversation as maybe not Toronto's a fair comparison, but just that shift from protecting little old Halifax to being open to the world and, you know, our whole conversation about immigration. Did you really sense that there's a sentiment shift amongst the population here?
I do. I can tell you there wasn't our government. You know, we did lots of trade missions with the federal government. We often went along and we had much better success. And I didn't mind telling people we could compete with Toronto. And I think we can. I think we have a better value proposition here, not only for the company itself, but I think we have a better value proposition for families. So, and I sense from people there's this belief we can, and you have to be in, I love the concept, and not the concept because it's reality, of the Voltas and the Cove across the harbor where these entrepreneurs are in it. Cove is really, you know, later stage companies that are doing really well and they're out in the marketplace. Some of them are at the front end, but Volta is often this incubation thing. And what I find really cool about it, our kids go in there and they have an idea and they're focused on commercializing the idea. They're less worried about protecting the idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get it's always kind of interesting for me. When I was growing up, you know, if you hadn't researched, you didn't get an idea, you did this with it, you kind of covered it up, and you didn't want anyone to see what you were doing. Well, you go to a vault, and our kids today are saying, geez, you know, that person there may be able to help me take this idea to as far as I can take it. And then, you know what, I might have to let someone else take it to the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff, and they're realizing that can happen here it's encouraging me to see it, and should be celebrated. Because that, I think, is part of what's leading to some of the success of how we've been able to retain young people.
And that communication collaboration is so important. It's what I keep on telling my children. Now they're 12 and 10, but, you know, of course it's important to be well-educated, but it's also important to have the confidence to tell your story, communicate. People buy into people's vision. You as a politician, I mean, they wouldn't have bought into you if you didn't present yourself and articulate a vision and a narrative that really struck a chord with people and not be ashamed by that, but celebrate that, like you've said multiple times now. Tell your story. And how do you get people to have the confidence to do that? I mean, when you're talking to your kids, I'm thinking about it myself. Like, storytelling, communication is such an important attribute.
Well, part of it is I would say for a long time, we wouldn't tell our own story.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Colin McDonald and John Risley built a company that, from the back of a half-ton truck selling lobsters to a billion-dollar company they sold. You know, look at the Bragg family, John Bragg, building a huge operation that's the largest world. He's doing that in Nova Scotia, but he has land and company. It's called Eastlink. You look at what Sobeys have done. You look at Highliner. There are examples of what when you step back and say, you know, but for a long time, we kind of looked at them as, you know, as they were doing something wrong. Well, in actual fact, we should be replicating what they were doing. They did research and development in their companies. How do I expand? What do my customer want? How can I preserve the blueberries longer? How do I make sure I keep lobster alive? How do I keep doing research and development, driving R&D in their companies? Well, that's how we do that within the rest of our economy. How do we make sure that we get the private sector thinking that you know, that's, you know, this isn't the time to stop. This is the time to keep going in and getting that mindset into our kids. And celebrating that success. That doesn't, and I think to me, if I was to say something to, which my kids are older than yours, someone else's success isn't your failure. It's meant to be celebrated. And then you figure out how to work from it. I used to say this, remember one of the first speeches I gave as premier, I was in Sydney. And I said, we have to stop complaining about Halifax. Which I wasn't sure how that was going to go over. And I said the same thing in my own writing. Because we have two children. Our daughter was in Halifax, and our son at the time was flying out west. And my logic was, well, I said, why do we complain about Halifax's success? I have two kids, and I said, I have one in Halifax and one who has to get a job out west. Which one do you think I see more of? The one I see in Halifax.
Yeah.
And that's because she's here. So why would I complain about a part of the province that's doing really well, providing opportunity for our kids, so I can see them? Same thing is held true for you. What we need to figure out in Annapolis, where I live, in the county of Annapolis, or in Sydney, how do we build off of that? What's happening there that we can, okay, where's our growth period off of their success as opposed to complaining about their success, build off of their success? Where's the place, it's like our economy, where's the piece that no one else is doing? Where can I add value? What's the kind of thing? Those are the kinds of questions that we need to keep asking ourselves, in my view. And be happy that someone has done well and a part of our province is doing well. Celebrate that. You know, I don't complain about lobster fishermen getting paid well for their lobster. That's a good thing. Yes, it means I don't get it to eat it as often, but that's the fact they're getting paid properly. So are the deckhands. So are the people in the fish plant. Mm-hmm. You know, it works its way through. And as I said earlier, so are the car dealers selling more trucks. Those are things we should be
the spin-off of that, yeah.
But also, hey, good for you. You know what? Good for you. Your 16-year-old who left high school and went and bought a fishing license and done well, great. Good for you. Or your family and you have built. We should be celebrating that. To me, success breeds success if you look at it properly. And look at it in a way that we can all build off it.
I was going to ask you, we often end these podcasts just asking, you know, give much thought to, it sounds like you have, to what you want your legacy to be, right? But I think we might have been inherently discussing that throughout this podcast. Would you agree with that?
I never really thought about legacy, to be honest with you. I'd like for people to think that when I've made a decision in government, I did it based on the best interest of all of us, not on the best interest of a few of us. That when I looked at a problem, I said, how is this impacting all of us, not? And sometimes that wasn't an easy path. It would have been easier to say, I'm going to give you more money and settle the agreement and be done with it. But I couldn't sustain an economy. I couldn't invest in other parts of the economy if I had spent all my money running government. But I'd like to think that people, I would hope to think people thought that that I made what I thought was the best decisions for all of us and not just a few of us. And I hope my legacy isn't finished yet. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I asked you if you've given any thought to that. Yeah. One more thing. I can't help myself. Of all the things that you've done in politics, all these amazing things you've done with your life, and it comes back to really maybe not paying attention to social media, but, could you ever have imagined that the phrase "Stay the Blazes Home" could have stuck to that degree? There was whole songs written. We were singing songs for months.
So it's a funny story. So again, I'll go back to you and I say you surround yourself by good people. My chief of staff was Lori Graham. Lori was a national journalist. She was deputy chief, the bureau chief of CTV nationally. She's from here. She was getting ready to retire, and I was fortunate enough that her global view, and when she was ready to retire, she was coming home. So I didn't know her that well. I just knew that she had a great skill set that I thought would be helpful to us as government as we were about to embark on an election in 2017. So I said, you know, give me 18 months. It turned out to be 5 years later. And she was instrumental in the whole concept around COVID. Our team from the elected body through to Dr. Strang and Lori as my chief of staff was pulling this together. And oftentimes, because of her background, she was very focused on being very specific about what we knew and communicating it as quickly as we could and as accurate as we could. So this was happening when we were reading a lot of stuff that was happening. I'd get a briefing in the morning and my team led by Lori would go and prepare remarks for the day. And she came into my office and she said to me, "Would you say stay the blazes home?" And I won't say for the listening audience what I actually replied with, but I said, you know, I heard my mother be able to say get the blazes outdoors or, so it really was a brainchild of hers and the staff. So I just mouthed the words.
Kudos to you, Lord.
Yeah. So I always give them credit and deservedly so. But it goes back to, I think we were hugely successful as a province, but I had good people around me.
Sure.
And I let them do their job and they let me do mine and we let Dr. Strang do his. And what we did was this, all of us doing our job, we put it in the frying pan, and we all came out with the best omelet we could.
It's amazing that Dr. Strang, for example, like the general public would have had little to no exposure to that position up until COVID, and we've got this guy on our TV that's all of a sudden like you see him every day for like I don't know how long.
So I would have my first outing was on March 13th, which was a Friday, because I was heading to Ottawa for a first minister's meeting, and then I canceled it. And I had met Dr. Strang probably the Wednesday before that, the 11th, for the first time. People think him and I had been friends for a long time, that we knew each other, we didn't. And I used to say to him, the only thing I knew about you is everything I liked to do, you told me was bad for me.
It tastes good.
Spit it out. And there was an unwritten rule in many ways that the elected body, there was an independence of public health from government. And it was one of the few places where, you know, and it was, I think you, that way across the country. It was definitely true here. And I remember when, we were starting to get watching what was happening across the country, and you know, there was a reservation by some, you can't get Dr. Strang over to OneGov, and we said, yeah, we can. we're not going to tell him what to do. We need to know what he's going to do, so we can then. Because his job was to follow the science and tell us. Our job was to actually deliver public policy that kind of dovetailed it, not. So we needed to know, and ironically, we were the only place that I know of in North America, or maybe elsewhere, where both the public health and the elected body came out daily for a period of time. And we did that to provide confidence to Nova Scotians that we were on top of this, and we didn't want any daylight between us. There were times when we had to do stuff, you know, there was a plane coming here with people to go, and do decommissioned Sable offshore. Well, I was on the call with the Prime Minister and Premiers at the time, and Lori and Dr. Strang were on a call with the company. And I'm on the call, and she comes in and says, you're going to have my back, right? I said, of course I am. What kind of silly question? I go back into the boardroom, and we turn the plane around. We said, if you land, you can land, but you're not staying. We'll refuel you and let you go. Because it broke the protocol of public health wanting to have a plan. If you're going to go back to work, if you're going to do something, we need to know the plan. So we supported public health in making, you know, those kinds of decisions, that when you think back on it now, like literally they said, sorry, we'll refuel or don't come. You think about that in today's climate, but that was the kind of relationship that the office had built with
alignments. Yeah.
Because it was, you know, we didn't know. Like, we literally, you know, there were so many things happening at that time that we just didn't know. We didn't know the outcome, didn't know the consequence, didn't know, you know, we didn't know the vaccines were going to be out. We didn't know the impact on young kids. We didn't know what would happen. And things were evolving. And then, of course, Portapique, which happened, which is probably the, you know, we had snowbirds. We ended up losing a helicopter off Greece. Down where I lived, the fishing vessel went down with six people, never coming back. So it all within a period of time, we had a lot of things happening, a lot of loss that, and the Portapique one was, COVID, as tough as it was, the world was going through it. Portapique was something that there's just no way to kind of come to terms with, to be honest with you, because you're, in a matter of 12 hours, people's lives have been turned completely upside down through no fault of their own, being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it was heartbreaking in many ways. It probably had, and still does to this day, probably had the biggest impact on me in my time in public life, because there was just so much sadness around it.
I think back on that time as well, and I have American friends who are very close to my family, and you know, their children go through active shooter drills on a fairly regular basis. That's not who we are. And so as much as tragic as that was and always will be, that's not who we are. That's not commonplace here in Nova Scotia or anywhere in Canada, really. But
no, and it also just the ugliness of it all and the people are trying to provide, the UN staff were trying to provide help to citizens during what was a pretty intense period of time for everyone, because we didn't know what COVID was going to do. In the meantime, they lose their life. Guy stops to help if somebody's in a car accident. We all do that all the time. Mm. It just happened to be the wrong car accident stopping. Mm. Those kinds of random acts of just violence and heartbreak is just, you just hard to, we as a team couldn't kind of comprehend it. Mm-hmm. My deputy premier was—that was her riding, and where she grew up, possibly. So, the impact as hard as COVID was, it was much easier than, not in the sense of easier, but it was different than that whole incident and the aftermath of it, which probably still living with.
From all the perspective that you've gained and experiences, I'm reading this book right now called The Psychology of Money, Morgan Housel, and he talks about this concept of enough and working in wealth management at RBC. Jeff and I, we come across wealthy people on a fairly regular basis, and some of them really struggle with what is enough for them. Have I taken enough risk or too much? Do I have enough money or not enough? Have you, given the course of your life, reflected on that and to what extent? Because it's very individual, right? I mean, for you, what is enough? I mean, you're obviously still in the prime of your life. You're very actively engaged in many facets of what it is you do. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it depends on what you're describing. If it's money, then people look at it in a different way.
Not just money, no.
But
more broadly than that.
Yeah, no. I think, I think it's what drives you. Money is a byproduct of certain things in lots of ways. If you look at an entrepreneur, I don't think they started it because they wanted, they wanted to be able to provide for the family. They didn't have this idea that I'm going to be a billionaire. It's a byproduct of what drives them and what makes them, it's for me, obviously you need money to do certain things and be able to do certain things, but there's also a part of you that you can have all the money in the world, but if you haven't, if you haven't used it in a way that's actually enriching other people, or quite frankly, providing you an opportunity to do something that enriches you and your soul in a lot of ways, and in a way that allows you to grow. That's one of the things that public life was able to do for me in lots of ways. I was compensated for what I did, but I would argue that probably what I gained more than anything was the personal growth stuff that happened to to me during that period of time. And I didn't leave because I thought it was enough. I have to find other ways to actually keep that,
right.
keep those juices flowing and one of the mm-hmm. things you want to do. But, you know, if people are struggling with the question of what's, how much is enough, that's a good place to be.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because you're analyzing, not the word legacy, but you're analyzing the footprint you've left mm-hmm. and what is the footprint you want to leave. And that isn't necessarily by making a huge donation of something. It could be, quite frankly, changing the life of a community member you're in, taking the talent that you've learned over a period of time, helping reshape a not-for-profit in the community that you mean matters to you, mm-hmm. or shaping the lives of your own children and grandchildren and how the best do that, in a way. Yeah.
I can only imagine the wisdom you bring into the conversations with Cox and Palmer, because you bring all of that tacit knowledge into your day-to-day working life and making a huge difference.
I hope.
Sure.
I'm still growing, trying to figure it all out.
You're having fun over there, though?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's a great place to be. They're a great firm. They're a big firm with a small town feel for me. That's what I like about them. And I meet lots of interesting people through their client base. People who are doing some interesting stuff, from bankers through to people who are putting their own mortgage at risk to drive an idea. That's kind of a cool place to be. Yeah. And I'm enjoying time. Our children are adult children, so enjoying that. And there's nothing quite like being able to do a few things with them that I wasn't doing before.
A bit more time for basketball.
No, I gave that up. I realize I'm not 30. I play a bit more golf than I did before. But just our son's in the business, and I do some stuff with him, and our daughter is an HR consultant, and she was in tourism. She's now recently working for government. Happened after I left. That happened after I left. So I'm getting to enjoy them as adults. We are, not just me, we both are. So it's that's a nice place to be.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks, Steve. We've had you almost an hour. I really appreciate this. This was really good fun.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm glad you were interested in my story.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Nice for being here.
Oh, thank you.